I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said this week that the escalation of violence in Israel and the West Bank could spin out of control. He urged Palestinians to stop their attacks and told Israel that its walls, checkpoints, and home demolitions risk worsening the crisis. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today and with Palestinian leaders later this week. Our guest, Dennis Ross, has played a key role in U.S. efforts to fashion a peace agreement between Israelis and Palestinians. He worked in the administrations of George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. His new book is titled Doomed to Succeed, and it's about the complicated relationship between the U.S. and Israel from President Truman to President Obama. He joins us on Radio Times to talk about that relationship, the larger conflicts in the Middle East, the nuclear deal with Iran, and the possibility of a two-state solution. He's currently the William Davidson Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a Distinguished Professor in the Practice of Diplomacy at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And Dennis Ross, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Are we witnessing a third intifada?
I don't know if it's a third intifada. We're witnessing what is a wave of violence that is different than what we've seen before in, I think, the following respects. One, unlike the first and second intifada, it's not organized. None of those who are involved in carrying out these acts of terror are affiliated with any group. They seem to be driven by social media. They seem to be incited by a narrative that's out there, which is untrue, that Israel is trying to change the status quo in what's known as the Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary, what the Israelis would call the Temple Mount. I say driven by it because, again, oftentimes it doesn't appear even that they've planned these things. They take a knife. And the second thing that sort of separates it from what we've seen before is it is a highly personal form of terror.
I mean, to use a knife against a person.
Yes. I mean, it's not you're going and there's a huge crowd and you don't see the faces. This is highly personalized. It literally is bloodletting, and it probably reflects what I think is incitement that drives them to feel that they're protecting the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is again the fact that you spread something that's untrue and it's on something so sensitive as the third most holy site for Muslims. It creates a kind of impulse, I think, towards anger and this kind of personal violence. But I think it's also a reflection of deeper anger and frustration from three different directions. One, they're extremely alienated from their own leadership. Two, they're frustrated by the fact that the Arab world is paying no attention to them. And three, obviously, they're angry at the Israelis. So some of the – in the first two intifadas, yes, there was anger and there was frustration, but there was organization and infrastructure, and we're not seeing that here. And it's hard to know whether this is something that will continue to just sort of go on for a period of time and then sort of peter out. It's just hard to know. And I think for those who are quick to label it, they should be a little bit cautious.
Are you saying it's not connected to the peace talks that haven't gone anywhere or even this resolution of some kind of two-state solution in the region?
Well, I think the absence of any sense of possibility or hope, I think certainly adds to the sense of frustration. There's no reason to believe that anything's going to be different. So I think that – of course that has to be a factor. But is that the – if we suddenly had peace talks tomorrow, would the violence stop? Mm-hmm. Would the terror stop? I don't think so.
So where do you think this violence is going then?
I think that it probably will diminish over a period of time. I think the key to stopping it is making it unmistakably clear nothing is going to happen to the Haram al-Sharif. I mean, one of the things I have suggested is that it would be good if Secretary Kerry could actually bring Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Abbas, King Abdullah of Jordan together in Amman. The reason I bring in King Abdullah of Jordan is that the Jordanians, the king, pays the Waft, which is an Islamic trust which actually manages the sites. The Palestinian Authority isn't permitted to be doing things within Jerusalem, according to what the whole Oslo process was about. And bringing them together and then having him come out and say, here is what the status quo is today. Actually describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what all the leaders have agreed is going to be unchanged. And have that highly publicized, such a meeting highly publicized, then the story that somehow you're having to protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is what many of those who are committing the acts are saying when they're arrested afterwards, if the, you know, a high percentage of them getting killed, but what they're saying is, I came to protect Al-Aqsa. So if it turns out that you don't have to, then that at least one of the spurs to this is taken away, and I think that's probably the primary one at this point. It doesn't mean if you could improve the overall climate, you reduce the prospect of, first of all, believing the worst. Part of why this is believed is because there's a tendency to believe the worst when nothing is going on.
Well, is there the kind of leadership that would have, first of all, that kind of meeting? They would come together to talk about this and then make that kind of announcement to try to tamp down the anger, frustration, and violence?
You know, close to a year ago, in fact, the secretary did bring together the prime minister and the king of Jordan. Because,
this
again,
is Kerry,
there was,
yeah,
so there was something similar to this, but it didn't produce the same kind of level of terror and violence that we're seeing right now. So I think this is, I think it could be done. I think probably Abbas is probably the most resistant to doing it because he feels at this point he has such little credibility with his own public that he, being in a meeting with Netanyahu, in his mind, doesn't help him. It hurts him.
I do want to play a clip, and this is actually something that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said earlier this week, a speech to the World Zionist Congress on Tuesday, as it turns out. Let's listen, and then we can talk about it.
This attack and other attacks on the Jewish community in 1920, 1921, 1929, were instigated by a call of the Mufti of Jerusalem, Haji Amin al-Husseini, who was later sought for war crimes in the Nuremberg trials because he had a central role in fomenting the final solution. He flew to Berlin. Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews at the time. He wanted to expel the Jews. And Haji Amin al-Husseini went to Hitler and said, if you expel them, they'll all come here. So what should I do with them? He asked. He said, burn them.
What he is saying there is that a Palestinian, this Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, essentially gave Hitler the idea of annihilating the European Jews.
Well, obviously, it's not the way history actually unfolded. Mein Kampf, I think, was written in 1923. I think that the final solution was being implemented when they had that meeting. I suspect what the prime minister was trying to do was to say there is a long history here of a kind of incitement that has produced these kinds of acts before, which is true. In 1929, the Grand Mufti did, in fact, spread rumors about the Jews wanting to take over and build a third temple there, and it triggered violence that, among other things, spread throughout all of Palestine and led to the killing of and the massacre of the entire Jewish population in Hebron at the time, a community that had been there for 800 years. So there is, I think he was probably referring to that.
It does inflame the situation, doesn't it? And he has been criticized by a number of people. I'm seeing a quote from the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. Even if unintended, the prime minister, by his words, plays into those who would trivialize or understate Adolf Hitler's role in orchestrating the final solution.
Well, I think, you know, it's pretty clear that across the spectrum in Israel, people have questioned, what were you saying? And it makes no sense. It's historically inaccurate. His own defense minister said, I don't know exactly what he was saying, but obviously, you know, we know Hitler was responsible. You know, I think at a point that we're at right now, what should be driving everybody is, how do we bring this to an end? You know, not how do we find ways to blame others. Let's find ways to bring this to an end.
You know Benjamin Netanyahu. You've had many conversations with him. You've sat off across the table from him. Why would he say something like that, though?
Well, I think he's trying to show that the roots of incitement in the Palestinian political culture go very deep, and there is no history ever of those actually trying to blunt the incitement. They perpetuate the incitement, and it deepens the hatred. It deepens the rage. It has a way of creating a sense of ultimate threat to what Palestinians, at least those who are religious, would hold dear. And so I think that's what he's trying to address. There were, what he's saying has a lot of legitimacy to it. There were certainly better ways to have put it.
Let me talk a bit about your book. It's a big book that you've written here, Doomed to Succeed. And it is about the relationship between Israel and the United States going back to 1948. As you say, Truman recognized Israel, I think, about 11 minutes after Israel declared itself a country. But the book is also about a complicated, sometimes contentious relationship between these two countries who clearly view each other as friends and allies.
Right. Well, obviously, the title, Doomed to Succeed, has a sense of irony in it.
Yes, it does.
And the reason for the sense of irony is that this is a relationship that has been marked by ups and downs, will continue to be marked by ups and downs. But there's also something fundamental that brings us together, drives us together, perpetuates a very close relationship. Part of it is a function of shared values. Israel is the only democracy in the region. Part of it is a function of shared interests that we see the same interests, see the same enemies and confront them. Part of it is also the Middle East, especially today, is so characterized by threats and breakdown. The whole state system is under threat. Every Arab state at this point faces one kind of internal challenge or another. The conflicts we're seeing are of the most horrible sort because they're over the most basic issue, which is identity and who defines it. And when it's all about tribe, sect, and clan, nothing is more basic, and nothing, therefore, triggers a more kind of atavistic kind of violence. And so against that backdrop, you have Israel, which has its own sets of problems, but it's the only state that actually has institutions, a rule of law, separation of powers, an independent judiciary, a genuine freedom of speech, respect for women's rights, respect for gay rights. There is no other country in the region, and it has a kind of basic orientation towards the United States. So against this backdrop of turmoil and conflict, which is so terrible and is unlikely to change for the next 10 to 20 years, Israel stands out. That's another reason why the relationship will be a tight one, even when we're going to have periods of tension, even when we have a relationship like the one we have today between the president and the prime minister.
And I do want to pick up on that. But what's so interesting, and we're almost up in a break here, is people talk about no daylight between Israel and the United States. And again, looking at your book, looking at history, there have been many times of daylight between these two countries.
Right. Look, there are five different administrations where the incoming president made a conscious decision to distance from Israel with the expectation this would pay off with the Arabs. It never did. The Eisenhower administration, the Nixon administration, the Carter administration, the first Bush administration, 41, and Obama. In each case, there was an assumption. I try to show in each chapter where what the events were, what the key assumptions were, and how you'll hear echoes, how the echoes reverberate over time because rarely are lessons learned. Mm. This one in particular, that if we just distance from Israel, we'll gain something, proves to be a very false assumption.
Well, let me pick up on that comment. And Dennis Ross is our guest on Radio Times today. And he does have a new book called Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. We'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Dennis Ross, author of Doomed to Succeed, and that's about the U.S.-Israel relationship for the last, 40, 50, 60 years since the creation of Israel. Interesting, and I do want to talk about President Obama and his relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu. At the same time, it's interesting just to remember, as you write, that Ronald Reagan is the only president to suspend arms shipments to Israel. You also talk about James Baker and his frustration in trying to deal with Israelis and other parts of the peace process.
Right.
Talk a bit about James Baker.
Well, Baker was a guy who, on this issue, brought no sentiment. I mean, he didn't look at Israel through a lens that it's a special country or special relationship the way someone like, for example, George Shultz did. George Shultz viewed Israel as being an extraordinary country and a special place. That was not Baker. Baker looked at the Israelis and the Arabs and the Palestinians basically as equal in his eyes, nothing special about him. When he got into the negotiations, though, Baker was someone who, you know, in his mind, he played it straight. He felt with Shamir, when Shamir was the prime minister, that Shamir ultimately wasn't very serious about peace. Mm. This is what led to his famous outburst in a congressional hearing when he said, when they're serious, they can call 202-456-1414, which was the White House switchboard.
Yes.
And then later with the Palestinians, when we were on the brink of being able to go to the Madrid conference, and we had been trying to work out what would be a Palestinian representation, at the very last minute after he had really stretched in a way that went beyond things that we had done before for them, you know, at the last minute, Faisal Husseini and Hanan Ashrawi came into a meeting and suddenly wanted to reopen a number of issues that he himself felt he'd already stretched very far on. And he said to them, with you people, the souk is always open, but with me it's closed. Got up, walked out and said, have a nice life.
Mm.
And they were sort of stunned, you know, and they're looking at me. It's just the two of us. It was the four of us there. And they look at me and go, what do we do? And I go, I sort of motion my hands like, I don't know. If I were you, I'd basically drop what you're saying because I'm not even going to go after him and tell him anything unless you do.
And did they?
They did. So when I – and we were actually in the Khan Jens house in Jerusalem, and I walked back to him, and he was – Baker was like walking back and forth. He was really angry. It's like you almost see the steam coming out of his ears. And I said, okay, they dropped the conditions. And so he pauses, stops, and he was in no hurry to go back and see him.
Make them wait for him to come
back.
That's
right. That's right.
He also, though, for a time was considering withholding money to Israel because of settlements.
It was the issue of loan guarantees. It wasn't withholding money. We never – in the Bush administration, there was never any withholding of the of assistance to Israel. But there was not a readiness to go ahead and provide loan guarantees, which reduced dramatically the cost to Israelis of getting loans, for absorbing what was – a very high number of suddenly Jewish immigrants coming from the Soviet Union. I mean, in 1989, there was like 12,000 who come. The next year, there's 189,000 who come. And so there was a desire to get loan guarantees. I tell the story in this, since I do a chapter on each administration, I tell the story that I had been the one to persuade President Bush in a meeting with President Bush and Baker that the first tranche of loan guarantees, there was a request for $400 million. And I said something that turned out to be quite right on the one hand and also quite wrong on the other. I said, look, there's no way that Shamir is going to jeopardize what is going to have to be a much larger request because the numbers are so large that they're going to need much more than this. And so I said, you know, your concern that if we provide these loan guarantees, it won't go for – you know, for building within Israel, go for building in the territories, and Bush was strongly against settlement activity. So I said he's not going to jeopardize that. He wouldn't be so stupid to jeopardize what is going to be a much bigger request later on. So I was right that there was going to be a much bigger request later on. I was wrong that he wasn't prepared to do things that would jeopardize it. And so when they didn't, we actually produced a letter of commitments to us on what they would reveal about what they were doing in settlement activity as a way of showing that the $400 million didn't produce a surge in settlement activity. When they didn't fulfill that obligation, Bush and Baker, understandably, weren't prepared to follow through on the next tranche. And there was a request of – it wasn't a tranche. It was a request of $10 billion in loan guarantees. In the end, that's withheld. And when Yitzhak Rabin is elected, it is released, but it's released only after there's a commitment that Rabin makes that he's going to limit settlement activity. He's not going to end it. And what the Bush administration decides at that point is that there'll be a dollar-for-dollar reduction from the loan guarantees, not from their assistance, but from the loan guarantees for our assessment of what they're building in the territory. Mm-hmm. So if there was, you know, $500 million worth of building in the territories, then there would be, instead of getting $10 billion, you'd get – you know, $9.5 billion in loan guarantees.
But the settlements continue. How much do you think that's an impediment to any kind of progress on this? And you do criticize President Obama in this book for talking about the settlements as being illegal. And that use of the word illegal, at least from your perspective, seems to take it into a whole other realm.
Well, I was, you know, I go to the White House. I'm the first 6 months I spend in the State Department where I have exclusively an Iran responsibility. The president asked me to come over to the White House in July. The settlement policy had been established from the beginning of the administration. My problem with it was not that we should try to limit settlements. We should. My problem with it was we established an objective we couldn't possibly achieve. You know, a complete settlement freeze, including natural growth. We were asking Netanyahu to do what none of his predecessors on to his left had done. Here he's heading a right-center government. And I said this to the president at one point. I said, what's his explanation supposed to be? You're asking him to do what Rabin didn't do, what Peres didn't do, what Barak didn't do. What's his explanation supposed to be? We should have framed the objective from the beginning of limiting settlement activity. When we framed it as a complete freeze, we gave the Palestinians in particular an excuse to do nothing. Say, we don't do a thing until you produce that. And in fact, Abbas goes and he gives an interview, says, I never made it a condition. The Americans made it a condition for negotiations. We actually didn't make it a condition, but he treated it as a condition, and he said, the Americans put me up a tree and they didn't give me a ladder. So good statecraft means you, if you can frame something, frame it in a way you can achieve it. On the issue of illegitimate, I was there in an early meeting after I got to the White House, and the term continued settlement activity is illegitimate. I said, look, we've always wanted this to be, since the Reagan administration, every administration has treated this as a political issue to be resolved. If you make it
a legal issue.
Right. If you make it a legal issue, you know, you're never going to get an agreement. You're going to make it much harder to resolve it. And when you say continued settlement activity is illegitimate, the solution in the end is going to be settlement blocks and swaps. There are existing settlement blocks in about 5% of the West Bank that you can absorb 80% of the settlers. This has been a basis since the year 2000 for how we're going to proceed. And by the way, this is language the president puts in his speech in May of 2011. So I said, if you say it's illegitimate, then you're undercutting what is one of the principal tenets that you're going to need to be able to resolve the conflict.
You write about when Vice President Joe Biden was in Israel. This was a couple of years ago.
Right.
And I think it was the day he arrived, or certainly during
that night. We'd been there for a day, and that night.
And the announcement of more settlements. I mean, that seems like a thumb in the eye.
Well, it was certainly taken that way by the president. And we, you know, Biden obviously wasn't happy. This was an embarrassment. And the truth was Netanyahu had been blindsided by his own bureaucracy. And so he makes a commitment to the vice president that they will not – this is in remote Shlomo, which is an area of Jerusalem. And he makes a commitment that there will be no ground broken there for at least 2 years. And the administration also uses the language – and we had a discussion on this. We condemn the activity. At the time, I said, look, I don't have a problem with us deploring it. I don't have a problem with us saying this is wrong. I don't have a problem with, you know, this compounds our efforts to try to get anything done. But we condemn terror. Mm. Now, you're using a term that we usually reserve for acts of terror. On this particular issue, the vice president actually agreed with me, but the White House wanted to use the term condemn because it reflected the level of anger, because there was a sense that this was a thumb in the eye. The truth is, Netanyahu had been embarrassed by it because he'd been blindsided as well. He made the commitment on that. He made the commitment that he would create a structure so that he wouldn't be surprised and we wouldn't be surprised. It's something that didn't always happen. But these were the commitments he made. And at the time when the vice president went and he saw Abbas and saw him privately, he used the fact that we had used the word condemned as a way of saying, here's the promise we got and look at the language we used. And and the fact is that Abbas was okay with where we were. We were then still surprised when the White House was still upset and instructed the Secretary of State to have a very tough phone call with Netanyahu even after we had elicited these promises.
So it's about language in many ways. It's about individual words that are used to describe conflict situations, problems between these two countries?
You know, anybody who's new to the Middle East doesn't tend to realize that every word carries with it a history. And that's why people often say this is a political minefield. And you're wise to sort of know the history before you walk into that minefield. One of the reasons I wrote this book was to show what the history is in every administration, show that a lot of the assumptions about the region get perpetuated even when they're wrong. And expose the importance of understanding what the realities in the region are as opposed to what some of the perceptions about that might be.
And that's Dennis Ross, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He has spent a number of, probably most of his career, dealing with the Arab-Israeli conflict. He has worked for three administrations, for President George Herbert Walker Bush, for Bill Clinton, for Barack Obama. And he's written about the U.S.-Israel relationship in a new book called Doomed to Succeed. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Steve from Ocean City to join us on Radio Times. And Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
As a starter, Mr. Roth, my background is Jewish. And recently, you know, we hosted a Palestinian who was an incredible, incredible human being, a nonviolent freedom fighter named Bassem Tamimi. And he was sponsored by the Jewish Voice of Peace. And
Steve, if I can just stop you there, only because we got a lot of people that want to talk to our guests, and if you don't mind,
okay,
just getting to your point.
I'll get to the point. And the point that I learned through him is, you know, number one, Palestinian lives do matter. And the only solution, I realize, is a one-state solution. And it seems that Israel will not be comfortable with that, no different than South Africa wanted to maintain tribal lands such as Lesotho and Botswana in the American South.
Well, you know what, Steve? I'm sorry to do this to you. Let me just take your point, and what he's arguing for is a one-state solution.
Well, you're seeing the consequence of what a one-state solution would be like. You have two national movements, two national identities. Look at the Middle East today. Wherever you have more than one identity, that state is actually at war with itself. So those who argue for a one-state outcome are suggesting that somehow the national identities, with two national movements competing for the same space, those two national identities are going to satisfy themselves being in one state. In the end, you're going to have one identity that seeks to subordinate and submerge and dominate the other. That is a prescription for enduring conflict and war, and that's what we're seeing in the rest of the region. The only answer is two states for two peoples. You have two national movements, two national identities. That needs to be accommodated in two states for two peoples.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. But isn't a democracy different? I mean, we're a democracy, and diverse people living in this country with diverse opinions and ideas. Israel is a democracy. Couldn't it be a place? I mean, there are Arab Israelis.
Yeah. There are Arab Israelis. And when you poll the Arab Israelis, they're not interested in living in a Palestinian state. They want to remain as citizens of the state of Israel.
Right.
It isn't to say that they may not connect with, identify with, but they're a minority. They're about, you know, 20 to 21% of the population. When I say two states for two peoples, it doesn't mean that you can't have a minority within it. But the idea that you're going to have a binational state and that's going to be at peace, show me one place in the Middle East where you have more than one identity that is at peace with itself, a national identity. You don't. And so for those who want to argue for a binational state, what they're arguing for is for an enduring conflict.
Mm.
You're not going to solve this. You're not going to settle this with that kind of an approach.
Is it also about demographics, which is that if the Palestinians eventually become a majority?
Well, it's one of the reasons that in the end, one way or the other, you'll have some kind of separation. Yitzhak Rabin was the father of the separation barrier. Now, he wanted to create a partition into two states for a simple reason. He looked at Israel and said, we can't be Jewish and democratic over the long haul unless we separate from the Palestinians. I want to negotiate it, but if I can't negotiate it, I'll create a barrier. Ariel Sharon, why did he withdraw from Gaza? Because he was looking at the demographics, and he said, this will buy time, but he actually left his party Likud and formed Kadima because he wanted to do a separation on the West Bank as well. In the end, you have this prime minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu,
right,
who in his speech at the UN said he's for two states for two peoples because he says, I'm against a one-state outcome. He understands what it means. The Zionist ethic was to create a Jewish democratic state. At some point, given the numbers, that will be difficult to sustain. There are some people who want to deny the demographics. What you can't deny is that eventually it's going to have an impact. Now, you can debate at what point, what the timing is. If the difference is 10, 15, 20 years, it doesn't change what is the ultimate reality. So you need to create two states for two peoples. You're seeing a picture right now. This is what you would face if you really want to create a one-state outcome, this is the future that you're looking at.
Do you think, looking ahead, and certainly based on your past experiences at the negotiation table, that there will be some kind of negotiated settlement in your and my lifetime?
Yeah,
we're talking, say, 20 years?
Yeah, it's hard to – look, Oslo began in 1993. So it's hard to be optimistic today. There is a level of disbelief that I've been worried about for the last 4 years, that the level of disbelief on each society is so deep. Israelis don't believe that Palestinians will ever accept a two-state outcome with them there. Palestinians don't believe that the Israelis will ever accept an independent Palestinian state. One of the things you have to do, you got to create calm again. Because no one makes big adjustments or compromises or concessions in an atmosphere of violence and fear. No one does that. So you have to recreate calm, number one. And number two, you have to address the sources of disbelief. You need to get Israelis to take steps and say, look, we believe in a two-state outcome. Here's the proof. One example, one of the recommendations I make at the end of the book is that Israel could take an initiative and say, we are not going to build in what we think is a Palestinian state. You know, ultimately, the border has to be negotiated, but right now we won't build in what we think is the Palestinian state, meaning we won't build to the east of the barrier. We have to negotiate a border, but until that time, that's what we'll do. Maybe you can give, you know, they could give incentives to those who live beyond the barrier to move back into the blocks or into Israel as a way of saying we mean what we say. Palestinians could actually put Israel on a map. Yes, Israel exists on no Palestinian Authority map. Pretty hard to convince the Israeli public that the Palestinians actually accept a two-state outcome when you can't produce a map. One Palestinian negotiator said to me, well, we don't know what their border is. I said, you know what you want it to be.
Make a map on your image of what this could be.
I mean, today they don't show Haifa or Tel Aviv as being part of Israel.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Dennis Ross, author of Doomed to Succeed. We are talking about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and the U.S. and Israel relationship. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Dennis Ross. He's got a new book called Doomed to Succeed, The U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. And he's speaking at noon today at the Free Library of Philadelphia. A lot of people want to talk to you. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You talk about Arab leadership in relation to the U.S.-Israel relationship, and you seem to be saying that the United States doesn't really understand the dynamic that's at work here. Explain what you have observed.
Well, one of the things that, as I said, that you've had five different administrations that consciously made a decision to distance from Israel because they thought they would gain benefits with the Arabs, and you also had constituencies in every administration, including this one, that believed cooperation with the Israelis would cost us with the Arabs. And it ignored what were the key priorities of Arab leaders, which was always their own survival and security. To the extent to which they saw the U.S. as being the key to that, they were never going to make their relationship with the United States dependent upon what the U.S. did with Israel. And that was something that consistently was misunderstood. Nixon, as an example, makes a decision to suspend arms shipments to Israel, not because he's punishing him, because he's trying to reach out to Nasser's Egypt. Now, he's doing this at the very moment that the Soviet Union is for the first time sending military personnel troops out of the Warsaw Pact, out of the Eastern Bloc. He sends his Undersecretary of State, Joe Sisko, to see Nasser after he suspends this with the expectation we'll get some response from Nasser, and Nasser just says, you know, he's not interested. So this assumption was, gee, we'll gain something if we do this, and we don't. You know, the first arms sales to Israel were made by President Kennedy. It was fought very hard by the bureaucracy because they said it's going to have a terrible impact on our relations with the Arabs. It had no impact on our relations with the Arabs because their priority was different. When President Obama comes in, he says there was no daylight between George W. Bush and Israel for 8 years, and what did it produce? Well, the irony is actually produced Sharon being prepared to withdraw unilaterally from Gaza, and it also produced Olmert's readiness to offer a very far-reaching proposal to Abu Mazen that drew no response. Abbas drew no response. But the president had this perception that – our problems in the Middle East and with the Arabs were at least in part not just a function of what Bush had done in terms of seemingly declaring a war on Islam, even though Bush himself never said that, but also because we were seen as being too close to Israel. Well, the irony is that that is not what created problems. And you look at the, you know, the President Obama's relationship with the Arab world today, it doesn't look so great. Mm. One of the reasons is he's perceived as not being reliable, fairly or not. So you look at what really matters to Arab leaders, and it's our reliability, because their security and their survival matters to them, and most of that is driven by intra-regional competition.
And I do want to pick up on a couple of things, and I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. But looking at the relationship between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, yeah. Do they like each other? And does that matter?
Well, they're not bosom pals.
Clearly.
And they're not going to be. They have, you know, there's a level of mistrust between the two, which is driven really by very different worldviews. And you saw it come out in terms of the Iran nuclear issue. In a lot of ways, even though the president says this is just transactional, not transformational, there was, you know, I write in the chapter on Obama sort of the evolution of our policy, because I was there in the first term. I think the president had low expectations about what could happen with the Iranians so long as Ahmadinejad was the president. When Rouhani got elected, it sort of changed his sense of what was possible. In a sense, he believed that our policy had worked. Our policy, that I, as I describe it in the debates over it in the first term, our policy was driven very much by a sense we're going to build pressure on the Iranians but leave them a way out. When Rouhani gets elected, the president sees his policy worked, and he believes that if you can empower someone like Rouhani, then it might actually produce a real change within Iran. There's a potential for that. You can't deny there's a potential for that.
Absolutely.
But Rouhani isn't Gorbachev. He's not the decision maker. The supreme leader is the decision maker. And the supreme leader is someone who fears a transformation within Iran. He fears a kind of cultural economic intrusion by us. So he's doing everything he can to foreclose that possibility, and he will validate his ideology by becoming more active in the region now.
Benjamin Netanyahu, as we know, invited by Speaker of the House John Boehner to address a joint session of Congress about the Iran deal. You call it a mistake.
It was a mistake. Look, it's fine. In 2011, by the way, Boehner invited him to speak, but he came to the White House first. And he went to his colleagues in the Congress first. In this case, he goes behind the back, not just of the White House, he goes behind the back of his Democratic colleagues. Israel, one of the points I make at the end, you know, the title of the book is Doomed to Succeed, which implies an inevitability, but I'm suggesting you have to work at it because there are ups and downs. There are reasons that bind us together, shared values, shared interests, shared threats. But there's also, you know, there's a potential for differences. And the one thing that has ensured that Israel remains, in fact, close to the United States, is that it's a nonpartisan issue. Israel is not a Republican or a Democratic issue. Israel is an American issue. When you politicize it and make it a partisan issue, then you're knocking down one of the pegs that underpins this relationship.
Let me get James from Bucks County to join our conversation. James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Thank you for my call.
You're welcome.
All right. I remember there was a comment made by Mr. Ross that the settlement phase was an impossible policy because that's something that has never happened before in some sort of impossible situation. But if I recall correctly, Ariel Sharon actually pulled all the settlements out of Gaza. So I don't understand exactly why that's not a possible policy in the West Bank as well.
Okay, fair enough. Go ahead.
He made the decision to withdraw from Gaza completely. There were 8,000 settlers in Gaza. Outside of Jerusalem, there are over 300,000 settlers. So I think it's going to be very difficult to withdraw that. There's no reason why, at the end of the day, if you have two states for two peoples and you do have nonetheless minorities within each, if you have, you know, as I said, you have about 20-21% of the Israeli population are Israeli Arabs, citizens of Israel. There's no reason why in a two-state outcome those settlers who are living in what would be a Palestinian state, they could stay there. They'd have to be they'd have to be citizens of that state. They would have to be – they'd have to observe and respect the law of that state if they wanted to stay. So you could have an outcome. And I will tell you that when we were at Camp David in the summer of 2000, the Palestinians at that time were offering that. It was the Israeli side that was not enthusiastic about that, but the Palestinians were offering that. Now, in the negotiations that took place that ended last year, the Palestinians had shifted their position. And these, I mean, one of the problems in trying to settle this conflict is
shifting positions,
and sometimes what's available on or one side is open to, it changes its mind. That's what we saw. At the year 2000, Palestinians were saying the Israeli settlers will stay here, but they stay under our law. That position was not something Abu Mazen was prepared to accept a year or so ago, but I don't know why it couldn't be the case. And in fact, in theory, it ought to be the case.
We have an email from Christopher who says, I'd like to point out that when the Israelis set up roadblocks, it's not news. When they set up checkpoints, that's not news. When they bulldoze Palestinian olive farms, that's not news. When they poison the Palestinian water wells, that's not news. When they raid Palestinian homes at 2 a.m., that's not news. But when a Palestinian attacks a soldier with a knife, that becomes headline news around the world. I would question, Christopher, in that those other incidents are news, clearly, because I've certainly read about them in the news. But nonetheless, he's saying that there's some kind of...
He's saying there's a double standard.
A double standard, exactly.
A lot of what he's saying, like poisoning water, that's not the government of Israel's policy. There may be settlers who have acted that way, and they should be punished. And by the way, they're not only stabbing soldiers, they're stabbing... Most of the people who are being stabbed are civilians. It also seems to be that his effort is to try to create a sense of the double standard that is far beyond the reality.
Fair enough. Also, a question from Jim. What's the difference between South African apartheid and what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians now?
Well, it'd be good to actually know what the reality of apartheid was. Apartheid was a state policy ideology where, in fact, a small minority ruled over a very large majority. Now, first of all, that's not the reality here, number one. Number two, the fact is that there is a readiness on the part of the Israelis to negotiate an outcome. One can agree or disagree with Benjamin Netanyahu, but one of the things he's saying is he's prepared today to negotiate the differences without any conditions whatsoever. So, you know, and he said at the UN that he wants two states for two peoples. So, you know, in the end, you know, I was asked in 2011 by each of them, Netanyahu and Abbas, did I think the other was serious? Mm. And I said, test them. You know, in the end, I'm not going to vouch for either side. Test them in the negotiations. I mean, one of the things that I say in the Obama chapter that bothered me is that in the negotiations, there has been, and not just in the negotiations, but the approach of the Obama administration, certainly in the second term, but throughout, the president has felt that the Israelis were strong and the Palestinians were weak, and therefore the onus was entirely on the Israelis. And that, in effect, gave the Palestinians a pass. The president felt the Palestinians were too weak to criticize. For the Palestinians, they have a political culture that is deeply infused with a sense of victimhood, with a sense of grievance, and with a sense of deep wounds. They feel they're the weaker party, and therefore they don't have to make any concessions. In fact, they view concessions as being illegitimate.
Now, isn't there some truth to that, though, that they are?
All of that happens to be true, but none of that justifies the idea that they don't make any adjustments. There can't be an outcome where they don't have to make hard decisions, too. Yitzhak Rabin used to say to me when he was the prime minister, I know we have to give up more, but I have to see they're prepared to do something that's hard for them. That would be the proof that they're prepared to make an adjustment. So the problem at this point and the problem in the Obama administration was when you give the Palestinians a pass, when you say they're too weak to criticize, you're saying they're too weak to be accountable. They're too weak to be responsible. Well, how can they have a state unless they can also be accountable and responsible? You don't do the Palestinians a favor when it's really, really hard for them to rationalize making these kinds of decisions, and then you basically say it's okay, you don't have to make them.
And that's Dennis Ross, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. So what should the Palestinians give up or offer?
Well, look, I'd like to start with what I was getting at before. Understand one thing. You have to restore belief on each side. So I said, you know, being prepared to put Israel on a map, that'd be a pretty good indication. Being prepared to rationalize the idea that both sides have to make hard decisions and have to make compromises. That would be a good place to start. Mm-hmm. Understand, the Clinton parameters were offered to the Palestinians and the answer from Arafat was no. Olmert presents to Abu Mazen a very far-reaching plan that actually goes beyond the Clinton parameters, and he never got a response. President Obama presents to Abbas in March of 2014 principles to solve all the core issues that go beyond what has been worked out and agreed with the Israelis and includes on Jerusalem two capitals for two states. Doesn't even draw a response. At some point, the Palestinians have to respond to a proposal to resolve the conflict. By the way, if they really want to put pressure on the Israelis to make decisions, say yes to something.
Let me get some callers in. We have a caller from Bala Cynwyd. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. This is it me?
It's sorry, you. No, that's okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Marty, I want to tell you I really like your show,
thank you.
I just want to correct an inconsistency or something that you said earlier. You mentioned that the Mufti was a Palestinian. He wasn't. That was 1929. That would have been way beforehand. And that wasn't Mr. Ross didn't catch that, so I just wanted to point that out.
Okay.
And I am really very disappointed with what Netanyahu said at the Zionist Congress. However, I will say that why are you picking on basically the one incitement that Netanyahu might have done when they're on the other side? It is replete with incitement. I have not heard any mention of knife attacks. When you ask what the Palestinians can do, how about stopping the knife attack?
Let me just stop you there. That's how we began the interview today.
I heard you, but I really heard a lot of discussion about incitement and settlement and not about actually what's going on right now. And I really want to thank Mr. Ross for the first time on WHYY in a long time. I've been hearing kind of the other side of the story, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mean, this is one of our tougher issues to talk about for, I think, all important, logical, and very reasonable reasons.
Look, this is a conflict that produces enormous passion.
Right.
And each side tends to come to it convinced that they're right and the other side is wrong. I was a mediator in this for a long time. Probably the most thankless task for a mediator is that you're always explaining the other side's needs. And no one ever appreciates being told what the other side's needs are. I would spend so much time sort of proving that I understood what, you know, you need so that I could be in a position where I could say, okay, if we're going to get your needs met, you're also going to have to address their needs. So let's understand what those are. And it was very hard to break through because, again, each side builds up a narrative. And they build up a narrative of, you know, that focuses on everything that they feel wounded by, threatened by, and are afraid of. And, you know, part of the challenge in this one is when you talk to audiences here, everybody comes to it with their own perspective. I have tried to sort of approach it from the standpoint that both sides have to be accountable. My problem, as I said, when I was within the administration, was this reluctance to be critical of the Palestinians. It became worse in my mind after I left the administration. I think the balance around the president changed from the second term, from the first term.
On that note, we have to end our conversation. Dennis Ross, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And the book is called Doomed to Succeed, The U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. And our guest is speaking today at noon at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. And I have to say, there are a lot of people that wanted to join the conversation and not enough time to have that discussion. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.